With the formalities over, I'd like to move straight to introducing our first two speakers, both from APRA, is Ian Lachlan and Kate Bible. Now, Ian's already known to many, possibly most of you. He was appointed as one of the three members of APRA in 2010, following an extensive career in the financial services industry. He's held a variety of senior management and board positions in a number of major organisations, both in Australia and overseas. And Ian became Deputy Chair of APRA with effect from 1st of July this year. Kate will be doing a tag team speaking role with Ian for the first session this morning. Kate's a Senior Manager of Policy Development of APRA. Again, she'll be well known to many of you. She's responsible for all policy matters relating to the general and life insurance industries, including the recent review and implementation of the LAGIC changes. Kate's been working for APRA for over 10 years in various roles, including internal consulting, actuarial services, frontline supervision, and now policy development. Although she specialised in general insurance at her time at APRA, she has supervised entities in all of the industries regulated by APRA. And with that, Ian and Kate, please. Thank you.
So here's what we're going to talk about. There's an awful lot here. So we're going to go through it at a fair clip, but you'll have plenty of opportunity for questions. I'm going to do the first two, Kate the next two, and then I'll close with the last one of those. So let's go to the introduction. Just at a very high level, LAGIC, of course, has been running since 1 January. It started really quite well. The industry's coped very well as well. And all credit to the industry for that. The focus for us now and for industry is bedding it down, getting out the bugs and wrinkles and making sure it works as intended. ICAAP summary statements are in place. They're generally okay, but improvements needed pretty much across the board and in some cases some significant improvement. Kate's going to talk a lot more about ICAAP summary statements shortly. In risk management, we've spent a lot of time on risk appetite statements, so good progress has been made there, really across the board, but there's still plenty of room for improvement, and so we'll continue to focus on that. And we are turning our attention to risk culture and risk governance, and I'll talk more about that shortly. But overall, we're pretty pleased with progress. So let's get into it in a bit more detail. So LAGIC implementation. As you probably know, a small number, and it is only a small number, of insurers who were materially affected by the new arrangements received individual transition arrangements. They were taken through a pretty rigorous internal process to make sure they were consistent and appropriate. From a capital coverage point of view, you know, the general insurance industry has enjoyed a pretty good last year or so. It ended up at the end of last year under the old system at about 1.8 times the capital requirements. It's at the end of March it was about 1.82, and it'll be very similar at the end of June. So generally speaking, the transition at an industry level from a capital strength point of view has been pretty seamless. A couple of areas of upcoming focus. Horizontal requirements comes into play from 1 January. The thing that surprised me there is we've had so little noise about it. So when we first proposed the horizontal requirement, there was all sorts of drama and feedback and so on, and it's just about disappeared. I'm taking that as a good sign, but I am interested in anybody's comments. We're also monitoring capital calculations, and as I said, generally ensuring LAGIC is well bedded down. We want to ensure, though, that the quality of LAGIC work is of a high standard. Lastly, the first set of returns flushed out some technical problems with APRA's forms, and I have to say that the standard of work wasn't up to speed, and we apologise for that. We did grant an extension, and generally the industry responded really quite well, so thank you for your efforts in overcoming those wrinkles. We've got a bit more work to do on that. Turning now to risk management and governance, I've got a few slides on this. I'm going to cover all of those items there, so I'll go straight to the next slide, which is about CPS 220. Now, as you know, This is the cross-industry risk management standard released for consultation in May. It was largely based on GPS 220 and LPS 220, and now it's being applied to ADIs as well as the insurance industry. Sometimes we get arguments it's going the other way, but in fact it's not. Whilst the consultation is now closed, APRA is analysing submissions and we are in the process of formulating a response. I'll talk more about the consultation on the next slide. The main new requirements, as I'm sure you know, are first of all, there must be a CRO. That CRO, as proposed, can't be the CEO, CFO, Head of Internal Audit or Appointed Actuary. The second requirement is that there must be a board risk committee to provide oversight and advice on the risk management framework. So let's look at that from the industry's perspective. We had quite a bit of feedback, 44. Remember, this is across all industries, though, and about half of those, interestingly, were from the general insurance industry. There were some concerns expressed about the requirement for a dedicated and independent CRO, and that was particularly from smaller insurers. As we mentioned in the discussion paper, we will entertain small exemptions for, exemptions for small entities, so that they're not forced to actually employ somebody unnecessarily. We probably didn't make enough, give that enough attention, but that's what we intended. But we will come back with a formal response shortly. Still on the CRO, an issue that's particularly relevant here is the issue of dual hatting. We received a few submissions arguing against APRA's proposal that a CRO could not also be the appointed actuary in particular, but also the other roles that I mentioned earlier. Now, some of the arguments included that the fact that the appointed actuary is in the best position to assess insurance risk, and secondly, that the imposition of a CRO might detract from the role of the appointed actuary. Now, in very simple terms, we believe requiring a CRO to head the risk management function and report to the CEO will, first of all, elevate the importance of risk management, and secondly, give it the attention that it actually needs. So in terms of APRA wanting a CRO to be separate from the appointed actuary, we believe this will encourage, first of all, an entity-wide risk view. That's not to say the appointed actuary won't have that, but as a matter of course, they won't necessarily. And while we would expect the appointed actuary to be the key source in understanding insurance risk, the CRO, of course, has got to be able to consider insurance risk along with all other material risks and present to the management and board a clear picture of the overall risk management of the entity. Now, interestingly, of course, an AA will generally, not always, but generally be involved in first line of defence activities such as pricing and reserving and capital management and so on. If the appointed actuary then serves as a second line of defence, in part involving independent oversight of the risk management activities of the first line of defence, a question that rightly can be asked is, can that appointed actuary in the second line of defence role oversee the work of the first line if they were also involved in the first line of defence? So we're going to spend some time considering that in a bit more detail. We've had some interesting arguments put to us, interesting submissions, and there are a few ideas that we're going to consider. Now, the final point to make on this is that there are many examples right now where there is an appointed actuary and a separate CRO, and they're working. Those arrangements are working quite well. Now, turning now to the Board Risk Committee. A separate Board Risk Committee, the general argument received would be that it would add little value because its work could be covered by the Board Audit Committee. Now, we don't necessarily accept that. Draft CPS 510 outlines different responsibilities for the Audit Committee and the Risk Committee in relation to the Risk Management Framework. The Audit Committee will review the effectiveness of the Risk Management Framework, so that's sort of third-line activity, while the Board Risk Committee will oversee the implementation and ongoing operation of the Risk Management Framework, so that's sort of more second-line. In other words, if there is a combined audit and risk committee, there'd be blurring of the second and third lines of defence. Now, all of this is very arguable, I know, but happy to talk more about it later on. And lastly, we had submissions on timing. 1 January 2014 was too soon. We've accepted that and just recently said we'll push it out to 1 January 2015, but we will have the requirements finalised during the course of this year. Okay, risk governance and culture. As mentioned, we've seen significant improvement in the quality of risk appetite work and in the statements in recent years, but we will continue to focus on how risk appetite is expressed and embedded and captured in management and board decisions. So the message here is clear. You need to keep the focus on that because we will be looking for further improvements. Turning now to governance. As mentioned in recent speeches by John Laker and by me, we're increasing the attention we give to risk governance and risk culture. And if you're interested in this, I'd encourage you to download those speeches from the APRA website. Now, effective risk governance is a fundamental requirement for high-quality risk management, and the board's role here is particularly important. The board sets standards and expectations that have a profound influence on the culture and on the management of the business and also on the quality of its governance. So as such, the board plays a critical role in risk governance. So turning now then to risk culture. Culture is often described as the way we do things around here. So risk culture you can think of as the way we do risk around here. Now, for the risk management framework to be effective, there must be a strong risk culture which is consistent with the company's espoused values and its risk appetite. And this starts with the board. That leaves a challenge for APRA. So how do we actually form a view about the quality of risk governance and risk culture? And we're sort of tackling that in two ways. First of all, we're increasing our interaction with boards. So we, as a matter of course, particularly for the larger organisations, meet with the boards roughly once a year. We're now also meeting with the chair of the board and the chair of the risk committee, typically, with a couple of us, so they're much less structured and much less formal. The ones we've done so far have proved to be really quite valuable. So that's changing the way we interact with boards. The second thing is that we aren't planning on attempting to assess the risk, the quality of risk governance or the nature of the risk culture. Instead, what we're saying to boards is you should really understand both of these things very well. You should control risk governance. You should understand the risk culture. So we're basically challenging boards to tackle those things and then convey that to us. And we've posed a series of sort of rhetorical questions for consideration by the board, and I won't go through all of those, but here are a couple of examples. How does the board satisfy itself that the espoused values are truly supported by management and staff at all levels? Does the board have a clear view of the risk culture to which it aspires for the institution? And how does it assess the prevailing risk culture? How does the board gain a clear understanding of the quality and consistency of decision-making throughout the business? And is it satisfied that this is driving an appropriate risk culture? So there'll be a good deal more attention given to that over the coming year or two. Turning now to CAT risk governance and management. The standard of risk governance and risk management of catastrophe risk is now and will be over the next year or two a very important focus for us. So again, you'll hear plenty from us on these topics. So we're looking for a few things. So board engagement in the oversight of CAT risk management, a lot more than we see at the moment. We want to see the risk appetite capture catastrophe risk, and again, we often don't see that. We want to see recognition that CAT models have weaknesses and limitations, and most importantly, that CAT models have considerable uncertainty in the results that they produce. And there's a general lack of understanding and recognition of that point, which we absolutely intent on addressing. And CAT models need to be recognised as only one input in determining reinsurance arrangements. You've got stress and scenario testing, expert advice, input of meteorological records and what have you. And lastly, there are specific requirements in GPS 116 and lots of guidance in GPG 116, which we strongly encourage you to read. About 18 months ago, we had a look at FCRs and the comments from the Point Lactuary about the suitability and adequacy of the risk management framework, and we did an analysis. We shared that with appointed actuaries. The Institute did some work on an information note, and then we did the same work again, the same analysis again, earlier this year. And I just want to show you how it's changed over the course of that year. Don't worry about the detail here. You're just looking at patterns. So the first one here was done early last year, and in very simple terms, the horizontal lines are things that we were looking for, and the vertical lines are things we were looking for. The horizontal line represents a company. It's just a sample on the screen. Where it's marked green, I know that looks a bit blue, but the right-hand column is blue, but the other colours are green and yellow. Where it's marked green, we considered that there was some valuable input, and where it was marked yellow, there was at least a mention, and where it's white, there was no mention at all. So on that picture, that was a pretty poor result. Here's the picture a year later. Okay, so you can see a marked improvement. If I just flick between them, you can see a marked improvement, a lot more green, still quite a lot of white, but that's sort of in the transition period. I think if we did that again today, most of those white boxes would disappear. So that's really quite a good outcome. Next thing is comments on in the FCR and catastrophe risk management. Under GPS 116, the appointed actuary of an insurer must review and comment on the adequacy of the calculation of the insurance concentration risk charge as part of the financial condition report. And that might typically include assessment of whether the ICRC is consistent with the risk appetite, whether the reinsurance cover purchased by the insurer is sufficient to cover the probable maximum loss, and so on. However, as we all know, that catastrophe risk management is an incredibly important part of the management of a general insurer, and particularly of its balance sheet. And we think, therefore, that we should expect, we should see, quite a bit more comment than we currently do in the FCRs about catastrophe risk management. So, for example, we'd like to see any comment on concerns with cat risk management. That could be the quality of exposure data, such as construction age and type and roofing material, etc. Comment on any environmental developments, urban development in flood-prone land, that sort of thing. Issues with geographic concentration, if you think in terms of Cairns or Christchurch. The allowance for cat risk and pricing. Is the policy adequately priced to cover the potential loss from catastrophes, and particularly in light of the introduction of flood cover, we haven't seen a lot of comment on the adequacy of the pricing for flood cover, particularly given the difficulty in actually pricing that accurately. The termination of probable maximum loss has it been based on just one model? Are non-model losses taken into account? What are the assumptions? What are the weaknesses? What uncertainty is there in the output from the model? What would other models actually tell you? And so on. So all of those things, I think, are valid things for the appointed actuary to be actually commenting on. And the last point, balance sheet strength. How would the insurer cope, for example, with a series of events over a particular time frame? And are the surplus assets, so thinking about regulatory capital, are the surplus assets sufficient to meet what might be within the insurer's risk appetite? Okay, with that, I'll hand over to Kate to talk about the summary statements and policy priorities. So, Kate, over to you.
Maybe just a reminder, if you have any questions for what Ian's spoken about or what I'm about to speak about, to text them through to the number. So obviously ICAP's a key component of LAGIC, and we're keenly interested in the quality of the ICAP summary statements, or ISS for short, and how ICAP will be used in the management of the business. So you'll probably be aware that APRA's reviewing ICAP summary statements in two phases, as outlined on this slide. So the first phase was a high-level gap analysis, which we completed earlier this year. And the second phase is a detailed assessment of the individual ICAP summary statements, including benchmarking against comparable entities. Feedback will be at industry level as well as individual to individual entities, and obviously we're starting with sharing some of that information today. Not every insurer will be included in this particular phase, but all of the ICAP summary statements will be reviewed in due course. Our next focus after that will be on the use of the ICAP in the management of the business. This will be done through our normal supervisory processes and engagement. In addition, we consider that the annual ICAP report has a critical role in this process, and we're considering whether or not to have a benchmarking process for ICAP reports in the first half of next year. So I'm going to outline some general themes and then go into some further detail on certain aspects. So while the level of detail will vary from entity to entity, there is an expectation set out in our Prudential Practice Guide, CPG 110, that the ISS refer to other policies and procedures but be relatively self-contained. We think a good litmus test for this is whether or not a new director could clearly understand the capital assessment and management processes of the institution from reviewing the ISS. We saw mixed results in this area, and I'll cover that during my talk. The ISS must have enough specific information in three key areas: a clear link to the entity's risk appetite, an explanation of how this ties to capital targets and triggers, and an outline of how this is embedded into the entity's operations. Poorer ISSs gave generic information of what a risk appetite should contain, or quoted at length from Prudential Standards or PPGs, or gave theoretical explanations of concepts related to risk and capital management. The ISS should contain entity-specific information. Over time, our supervisors will test what is said in the ISS against what the entity actually does in practice. And so, as I've just mentioned, the ISS must give us enough information about how the ICAP works for the specific entity so that we can do this analysis. Where entities have a Level 2 group, it's important to explicitly describe how the ICAP applies both to Level 1 and at the Level 2 group. Given how capital requirements operate, we consider this to be essential, and I'll touch on Level 2 groups again later. Most of the ICAP summary statements mention key components of the ICAP, such as risk management frameworks and strategies, risk appetite, capital management plans, strategic and business plans, and reporting and review processes, although there's some variation in the detail and quality. One of the weaker aspects of noted was a lack of description as to how these components were integrated. It's important for an entity to have an integrated process and to reflect this in the documentation. As noted on the slide, self-identified areas of improvement included risk appetite, integration and stress testing, so no surprises there. In relation to governance specifically, there are a number of points we'd like to make. In respect of board ownership and involvement, better practice would see the ISS describe the respective roles of the board and management, how the board is engaged in the process of developing and finalising the ICAP, and what mechanisms exist for the board to provide and receive feedback. There should be a clear delineation between board ownership, board oversight and board approval of the ICAP versus the allocation of the management responsibility for documenting and implementing processes. The scope and objectives were not always clear. Better practice examples included defining the scope by using organisational charts, through commentary on the business activities being covered, and using a summary table specifying which legal entities in the group are included and excluded from the ICAP. Some ISSs do not clearly set out the objectives of the ICAP, while others had a broad generic statement like to ensure the appropriate capital levels are available to support risks in adverse circumstances and to meet regulatory and contractual obligations. A weaker example noted that the ISS was produced primarily for the purposes of complying with APRA's prudential requirements, clearly inadequate. Clarity of scope and objectives is also linked to having the ISS being forward-looking. Better practice would include forward-looking aims, such as using the ICAP as a strategic management tool, providing insights for the board and management into the entity's risk profile and forecast capital position. This also might include linking the ISS and business plans by discussing risk and capital projections. It might also note that the ICAP is used to inform business decisions, but is also influenced by and reflects the impact of business decisions, assisting to achieve desired levels of return on capital. Most ISSs lacked sufficient detail on independent review. The key requirements are that the reviewer needs to have appropriate skills and be operationally independent of the conduct of capital management. Some entities recognise that initially external parties may need to be engaged to conduct the reviews until appropriate skills have been developed internally. Others felt that their internal audit teams had sufficient skills already. Note that we cannot concede that the appointed actuary could review the ICAP since they are not operationally independent of capital management. Better practice would be for the ISS to describe the purpose of the independent review, provide a description of the components to be reviewed and related timeframes, and describe parties responsible for undertaking the review, or at least options as to the parties that may conduct the review. In respect of board monitoring and reporting processes, a good example, good practice example was ICAP summary statements including a table of proposed board reports, a brief description of content and purpose, a distribution list, timeframes, and the parties responsible for preparation. A better example included a sample of a dashboard that would be provided to the board. In contrast, a poor example was where there was no detail on reporting and monitoring processes, merely cross-references to other documents. Moving on to risk management. In terms of risk coverage and description, entities used a variety of approaches for categorising risk, with the most common approach being to align with the risks with the regulatory capital requirements. General insurers need to ensure that the business activities and risks relevant to the Level 1 entity, and if applicable, the Level 2 group, are adequately identified and described. There should be sufficient clarity as to the nature of risks, such as they could be categorised, and description of the entity's approach to managing each risk, correlations between risks and the basis on which capital is allocated. A poor example used a very simplistic matrix listing the risk categories, providing no further detail. In a number of cases, risks that are relevant and needed to be considered were omitted. For example, there was often limited discussion on liquidity risk, or where relevant, consideration of risks associated with being a member of a group, such as contagion risk and risks related to operational dependencies from shared functions and the like. Most summary statements provided at least a broad description of what is covered by the risk management framework, which may include an overview of the policies, procedures, systems, and people who are involved in identifying, measuring, monitoring, and managing risks. Better summary statements provide an understanding of how the overall process works. So, for example, how the entity's related policies and procedures fit together in practice, and outlined reporting, monitoring, and governance processes for risk management. Several supplemented this description with a comprehensive list of related policies and procedures, how risk management processes have been built into the functions and controls at business unit level, and how these roll up to part of the overall risk management approach. Weaker ISSs contained insufficient detail to provide an understanding of how overall risk management processes work, or conversely had too much procedural detail. As mentioned earlier, another example of poor practice is the use of generic or theoretical examples of risk management structures with no processes and processes with no specificity to the entity. Where entities relied on group-wide policies, the ICAP summary statement needs to clearly state how this works in practice or how group-wide policies are operationalised or tailored for the application to the particular entity. In relation to the link between risk appetite and capital, a better practice example was where there was a quantified risk appetite, where a quantified risk appetite would be tested against a range of scenarios discussed and approved by the board. This would test how risk appetite translates into required capital. The board can then assess its comfort with the probabilities of failure and anticipated timeframes for returning to target capital levels. In this way, there is a feedback loop, and the scenarios become a primary tool used by the board to test and engage on how their risk appetite translates into required capital. Most ISSs focused on risks that directly impact capital. Generally, there was limited consideration of risk appetite in relation to other material risks. Better practice would see linkage between the risk, the tolerance for the risk, and the capital needed to support that tolerance. If the risk appetite for a risk cannot be quantified easily, there should be discussion on mitigants and the ability of the entity to address such a risk event. So moving on to some specific points in relation to capital management. As noted earlier, integration needs improvement. There is scope for summary statements to better recognise and describe the capital considerations not only influence strategic and business plans, but in turn are influenced by business outcomes. And thus the ICAP can help achieve a better articulation of the risk appetite. Again, as noted earlier, better ISSs outlined a process where the risk appetite is considered in determining target capital levels, and levels of available capital are used to test the articulation of the risk appetite and business decisions. These aspects were often noted as being under development. Targets are often expressed as a probability of not breaching regulatory requirements. Where relevant, economic capital targets should also be described. The summary statement should describe at a high level the approach to determining capital, to determining target capital. For example, consideration of individual risks for the level one entity and, if applicable, the group. Determination of the capital required for each of these risks to result in a certain percentage probability sufficient over a set period of time, which should be in line with the risk appetite. And the incorporation of stress and scenario testing outcomes to establish the link between the amount of risk deemed acceptable as per the risk appetite and the level of target capital. There was not always consideration of quality of capital requirements. We would expect entities to explain the reasons for their chosen capital mix at level one and also at level two where applicable. Some general insurers did not adequately document sources of potential new capital. Some referred generically to capital raising options but did not provide much entity-specific detail. A number of entities noted their ability to access additional capital from a parent or group but did not include much detail of how this would work in practice. ICAP summary statements should describe matters such as transfer approval processes, how quickly transfers can occur, including possible legal or other impediments in certain circumstances, and the impact adverse market conditions might have on transferability of capital within the group. With respect to granularity in describing triggers and actions, better practice would see clear explanation of the factors listed on this slide. Some specifics include clarity in describing how specific trigger events give rise to specific actions, the impact of potential actions on improving the capital position, the likely timeframes for the management actions to take effect, and the board's expectations of how long a return to a normal capital position would take, whether planned actions are realisable in a severely stressed scenario, the impact of any key dependencies such as key investors or particular markets, specific consideration of triggers and actions relevant to the group, if applicable, and relevant contingency plans. Notification to APRA of a breach or prospective breach or any significant adverse changes in the capital base or prudential capital requirement also needs to be addressed as required in the standard. In terms of capital monitoring and reporting, better ICAP summary statements include tables showing the relevant reporting in relation to risk and capital, the timeframes, the parties responsible for preparation, the audience, and a summary of the content. Finally, on stress testing. This was a self-assessed area for improvement, and planned improvements generally were indicated for the next 12 to 18 months. Typical improvements identified included more sophisticated and better use of scenario analysis tailored to the risk profile of the entity, the use of reverse stress testing, and enhanced mechanisms for stress testing outcomes to feed back into processes for strategic and business planning, risk and capital management. With respect to the level of detail, most ICAP summary statements have limited or in some cases no details on the scenarios and methods to be used, the process for determining sensitivity and scenario parameters, the roles and responsibilities for stress testing, and the reporting and approval requirements. General insurers need to consider insurance-specific stresses, not only general economic or asset market stress scenarios. As you know, we often engage in discussions with entities as to whether or not stress tests are sufficiently severe. Stress tests should include a variety of plausible and severe scenarios tailored to the entity's risk profile. Reverse stress tests should also be considered. Most ICAP summary statements did not have much description of effective board engagement in the stress testing process. In some cases, the appointed actuary appears to take the lead in determining changes to parameters for stress testing and ensuring that material risks are covered while the board approves the recommendations. As Ian mentioned earlier, in discussions with general insurers, we've been emphasising that while CAT models are useful, their outputs need to be carefully considered and challenged by boards in particular to ensure that the answer from the model is not blindly accepted. An appropriate judgment and sense checking is applied. ICAP stress testing should be approached in a similar fashion. Better practice would see the board being informed of the basis for stress testing inputs, involved in reviewing the outcomes of stress testing and challenging management, having input into any changes to the parameters or scenarios based on the outcomes, and considering changes to risk appetite, capital management, and strategic and business plans to reflect stress test impacts. Separate to the ISS, the board's deliberations in these areas should be appropriately documented. That brings me to the end of the feedback on ICAP summary statements. Moving on to our policy priorities, I'm going to cover the four that are listed here. Obviously, reinsurance is a key focus area for APRA. There are a number of areas where we're focusing in this space. Firstly, APRA has recently consulted on an annual reinsurance data collection. This data on reinsurance counterparties is important to us in understanding the exposures of insurers to particular reinsurers, groups, domiciles, etc. In particular, the impact that a downgrade or failure of one of those reinsurers may have on the capital position of a general insurer or the industry is a focus. APRA proposed to collect this data in four reporting forms, two for general insurers and two for insurance groups. One form collects relevant information about on-balance sheet exposures to assess the impact of a reinsurer downgrade. The second form requires the insurer to undertake an exposure analysis to assess the impact of a complete failure of a reinsurer on each component of the prescribed capital amount and the capital base. This type of analysis is already expected to be undertaken by insurers as part of their ICAP and stress testing. We also propose that the reinsurance arrangement statement requirements be amended to include the specific details of reinsurance counterparties on each reinsurance program. The consultation on the proposals closed on the 14th of August, and we're currently considering the industry feedback before finalising our position later this year. The first return will be due, the annual reporting package due 30 April next year for any insurers with a 30 to 31 December balance date. There are a couple of other focus areas besides that recent consultation in relation to reinsurance. We're currently doing some work internally on developing good practice guidance in relation to the reinsurance arrangement statement to assist with consistency in approach to providing information to APRA. We've been doing some work on alternative risk mitigants. These continue to play a very small role in Australia. However, we are monitoring developments, gathering information. We remind insurers that any credit for these types of products in the insurance concentration risk charge needs to be approved by APRA. Finally, we're also considering whether any further work needs to be done in relation to collateral requirements and in relation to enforceability of reinsurance contracts. Another policy priority relates to disclosure arrangements. Under LAGIC, Pillar 3 requires disclosure of the prescribed capital amount and capital base and their components. APRA proposes to strengthen these requirements given the recently implemented changes for ADIs, as well as international good practice, including the insurance core principles. The recent ADI enhancements include a full reconciliation of capital, the main features of capital instruments, a breakdown of risk exposures, and details in relation to remuneration. APRA is currently considering the extent to which these are relevant and appropriate for insurers, and we will be consulting on that. In conjunction with the review of the disclosure requirements, APRA consulted in early 2013 on the potential determination of data previously and currently submitted to APRA as non-confidential. The proposed determinations would increase the breadth of statistics available to users, as well as improving the timeliness and usefulness of the data for general insurance analysis. It also helps us to incrementally improve our general insurance publications, including publishing more detailed institution-specific data and publishing for the first time group-level data. APRA plans to decide which insurance data submitted to APRA is determined non-confidential this year, however, only after we continue further dialogue with industry on the issues and concerns raised. In the meantime, we continue to apply all confidentiality protection measures to ensure confidential information relating to individual insurers cannot be derived from our published statistics. APRA is currently developing an information pamphlet for distribution to new and current board members. This is a concise and plain English view of APRA's expectations for board members in the oversight of prudential matters. This work involves a stock take of the specific requirements of boards to assess any inconsistencies across our industries and whether the requirements are too onerous. In short, are boards being asked by APRA to do too much too often? Conversely, as the bastions of risk culture, are they being asked to do the right things often enough? We will, in our usual way, consult with interested parties on any changes that follow from this stock take. Our motives are clear. Reinforce good governance, but minimise any box ticking so that boards and supervisors can direct their focus where it's most appropriate, on desirable values and behaviours implemented by strong management teams. Finally, APRA is currently undertaking a comprehensive review of the attestations in place across all industries to ensure that they are clear, consistent and complete. This will include assessing if any attestations at board level should be lowered to senior management. On that note, Ian, do you want to talk about overseas development?
Okay, so this is the last item on our agenda, overseas developments. So I think, as you all know, APRA is a member of the International Association of Insurance Supervisors. It produces the insurance core principles that Kate referred to just recently, amongst many other things. COMFRAME is a piece of work, short for Common Framework, aimed at the supervision of internationally active insurance groups. And the idea is that you have a consistent common approach to the regulation and supervision of those groups around the world, and driving international consistency and in competition terms and so on. So that work has been going on for some time, a number of years. It's been tortuous, to be honest. It's really, really very difficult. You've got multiple views from around the world, of course. You've got many different practices. Very difficult to get agreement. And so the process marches on, but marches on very, very slowly. I don't think we'll see any strong, really useful output for another couple of years, but we'll just have to wait and see. In any event, I don't expect it to have a big impact on insurance groups in Australia. And the reason for that is that most of the practices that COMFRAME is trying to put in place are already in place in APRA's prudential standards, either at level one or at level two. Also, our capital requirements, and I'll talk more about them briefly, are generally a bit stronger than what appears around the world. And so it's very unlikely that the imposition of COMFRAME would result in any significant change in the capital requirements for an Australian group. Let me turn now to global systemically important insurers. So post the GFC, the Financial Stability Board was given much increased powers and relevance by the G20. It initially turned its attention to the banking world, and by and large the FSB is populated by bankers. And from that came the idea of global systemically important banks and domestic systemically important banks. In more recent times, they, the FSB, have turned their attention to insurance. The IAIS had already been doing some work on this and had developed a methodology for determining the systemic importance of insurers, global insurers. It's rather a complex process and really quite difficult to get agreement and so on. But nonetheless, it produced this process. And what that does is actually rank insurers. So if you think of global insurers, it ranks them from the most systemically important down to less systemically important. And it takes into account substitutability and a range of other factors in that process. Now, with the FSB's attention turning to insurers, they, the FSB, wanted to see a list, a sort of a subset, which would be given special attention. So the IAIS also did some work on the management of systemic importance, so what actions could be taken in the event that an international group was determined to be systemically important. The FSB decided that there would be 9 in that group, and they've announced the names of those 9, so it's just the top 9 in the list, with the exception of reinsurers. And there's a strong belief amongst certain members of the FSB that the global reinsurers need to be treated differently to other insurers because of the interconnectedness. So that's another one of the attributes that are considered in determining systemic importance. So there's another piece of work going on the global reinsurers to see whether or not they should be determined to be systemically important. Now, all of that leads to the idea of domestic systemically important insurers. And in due course, we, APRA, will turn our attention to that. And I would think that there would be some domestic systemically important insurers in Australia. The question is, what would actually be done about that? So measures range from, at the global level, range from encouragement to separate systemically important activities from non-systemically important activities, quarantine them in some way, sell them, and so on, through to a capital loading. Higher loss absorbency is the terminology that's used. So the question that we need to focus on in Australia, there are a few questions, but one is, how would we determine domestic systemic importance? And would we use the same sort of criteria as was used, as were used for global systemic importance? And the second is, once we determine an insurer to be systemically important domestically, what would we actually do about it? So we haven't really turned our minds to that in any great detail. But we will over the next year or two. The last item on this slide is an international capital standard. So for many years, there's been debate at the IAIS about the merits or otherwise of a global capital standard as similar to the Basel requirements for banking. It's waxed and waned, the argument. There have been sort of a number of half-hearted attempts to do something about it. What's happened most recently, which is quite significant, though, is the Financial Stability Board has, quote-unquote, requested the IAIS to develop 2 things. One is what they call a straightforward backstop capital measure, and the parallel there in the banking world is the liquidity ratio. So in the Basel requirements, you've got sophisticated formulae to determine capital requirements, but then there's this backstop arrangement, which is about, I said liquidity, it's leverage ratio, I beg your pardon. There's a backstop arrangement about how leveraged the balance sheet is in very simple terms, and equity has to exceed, again in simple terms, 3% of total assets. So it's just a simple backstop measure. So they've gone to the insurance world and said, you should have the same sort of thing. And we would like it by October next year. Okay, so this happened a month or two ago. So for years and years it's been going on, but by October next year we have to have a straightforward backstop. And then by about 2019, they are saying that for IAIG, so the International Active Insurance Groups, there should be a global capital standard. Now, that's a few years away, but nonetheless, that's what's intended. So how will that affect us in Australia? In the short term, it won't have any impact at all other than generating quite a bit of work for us as we participate in that activity. Will it eventually have an impact? Yes, it probably will, but I wouldn't expect that it would drive our capital requirements up to any significant extent. It might twist them and turn them here and there. And the reason for that is because there are so many countries that are going to be affected here, and because the capital requirements in some countries are really quite weak, then there will inevitably be a lot of pressure to keep the initial global standards reasonably low. Nonetheless, something to keep an eye on and something that you need to understand. Now, that brings us to the end of our formal presentation. So I might hand back to Adrian, and he can take us to the next part of the day. So, Adrian, over to you.